The words of our call to worship are by the Reverend Gretchen Haley. In a world that feeds on moral outrage, we are here to cultivate moral courage. In a time that prizes picking sides, we gather to draw a wider circle. And in a culture that teaches us to get for what we give and to ask, what's in it for me? We come to practice generosity and to remember we are all in this together. In the midst of life's bitterness, we choose to sing, to give thanks, to laugh together, and to be keepers of beauty, to offer a place of belonging for all who come in gladness and in pain. We come to resist the push to the next moment, and the next moment, and the next, to slow down, to breathe more deeply, to feel a part of something greater. If only for this hour and in this space, let us be the change we wish to see. Come, let us worship together. Let us deepen into the spirit and mood of worship by the lighting of candles and some centering music. And Mark is going to light our candles. We have lit our chalice this morning, grateful for the love that we experience in this beloved community. May the flame light the way for all who seek abundance. Please join me together in reading our affirmation, which is posted here in the front. Love, the spirit of this fellowship. This is our great covenant. To dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, and to help one another. It's a tradition of this congregation to mingle and share greetings with one another, so please take a few minutes to do that. If you would prefer to stay seated, people will come to you.
Thank you.
Our reading this morning is a responsive reading. It's number 586, found in the back of your gray hymnals. The words of Abraham Lincoln, the idea of democracy. Please respond with the words in italics. As labor is a common burden of our race, so the effort of some to shift their share of the burden onto the shoulders of others is a great, durable curse of the race.
As I would not be a slave, so I would not be a master.
This expresses my idea of democracy. Whatever differs from this, to the extent of the difference, is no democracy.
Our reliance is in our love.
Destroy this spirit, and we have planted the seeds of despotism at our own doors.
Those who deny freedom to others deserve it not for themselves, and cannot long retain it.
Why should there not be a patient confidence in the ultimate justice of the people? Is there any better or equal hope in the world?
Let us have faith that right makes might, and in that faith,
and now we turn to the opposite end of the hymnal for joining our voices together in hymn number 1. May nothing evil cross this door. We'll sing all four verses. With all our voices. More than four voices. Thank you.
Thank you.
We come to the part of our service where we've greeted one another, we've settled in a little, and we take a bit of time to turn inwardly in prayer, spoken words, meditation, silence, music. We'll begin with a prayer and then continue with the sharing of joys and sorrows before we close with a meditative musical response. Today's prayer is one I chose because I think it's very fitting for our times. It is a lamentation written by Reverend Liz Weber, and she's written it in the style of a call and response, much like our responsive reading. I'll have a part and you'll have a part. So please respond with the words that are printed in your order of service. We cry out and rise up. Can we say that? We cry out and rise up. When justice is all around, we cry out and rise up. When families seeking asylum are forcefully separated, we cry out and rise up. When migrants and immigrants are inhumanely detained, we cry out and rise up. When there has been another mass shooting,
we cry out and rise up.
When our democracy is undermined,
we cry out and rise up.
When those with power use hostile rhetoric, when they show unabashed disregard for human rights,
we cry out and rise up.
When we fear for our future,
we cry out and rise up.
When our hearts despair,
we cry out and rise up.
When we are enraged,
we cry out and rise up.
When we lament and when we rally, when we act in solidarity,
we cry out and rise up.
When we work together for justice,
we cry out and rise up.
When we side with love,
we cry out and rise up.
When we side with love,
we cry out and rise up.
When we side with love, we cry out and we rise up. May it be so. All right, story time. So the topic today is democracy, and I want to play a little game of make-believe with you. Oops. Did what? Oh, yes, sorry. You have to excuse me. We're going to close that part by singing together, Comfort Me. For those of you who are new to this song, it's very meditative. It's a zipper song, so that means that a large part of it repeats from verse to verse, and only a small part of it changes. It is in your hymnals, in the teal paperback hymnals, number 1002. There are four verses. If you're not familiar with it, join in when you start recognizing it and feeling it.
Thank you.
For today's story, I'm going to ask you to do a little make-believe and imagine. So first, I need to know how many of you love baseball. You like to play baseball? Yeah, a few of us still do. You like to go to baseball games or watch baseball games on TV? You might even have a favorite team that rivals some other favorite teams, right? So imagine the governor of New York, or any state you happen to live in, Georgia, sends out a notice that there's a new law, baseball is now illegal in the state. You are forbidden to watch, to attend a baseball game, because there won't be any, to play, even a sandlot game. You are even forbidden to own a baseball or a bat. But frisbees and soccer balls are fine, but no baseballs. And doing any of these things, overtly or surreptitiously, gets you sent to jail. Now, what would you do? Let me hear, what would you do? Jerry.
I'd go to jail. Let them put me up and beat me.
Okay, you would stand your ground and go to jail. So he would shrug it off and play ball, right? Eric.
I think I might start some sort of underground baseball club. There's a black market. There'd be a black market for that immediately.
An alternative underground movement.
My first response was leave the state.
Yes. Yes, I'm out of here. I'll go to New Jersey. Might have to change my team affiliation, but that's okay. Ellie.
I think I would buy stock in a softball company.
That is shrewd investor language. Okay, accepting the reality and working within the system as it's been set up. Nobody's doing a petition, I noticed. Nobody's showing up in Mount Kisco outside Governor Cuomo's residence and protesting. No one's filing a lawsuit yet. But those are some of the things we might consider doing. Now imagine if you were forbidden from speaking your mind. What would you do? On any matter. Imagine if you were forbidden from speaking your mind in your state, in your city, in your congregation. I suspect we would adopt many of these same different approaches. So I just want to leave that thought with you for a while. Not all stories have resolutions that are pleasing. We move now to the offering which sustains the life and the ministries of this congregation. Please give generously. The music for today's offering. Oops, I forgot it. Thank you. It's a song, What Have They Done to the Rain? It was written in the 1960s by Malvina Reynolds, and it was part of a campaign to stop above the ground nuclear testing. That nuclear testing was putting strontium-90 into the air, and it got washed down by the rain into the grass, of course, where cows ate it, where cows produced milk that children drank, and it was deposited in their bones. Mothers, by saving their children's baby teeth and sending them into the scientist, were behind the movement that led in 1963 to President Kennedy signing the treaty against above-ground nuclear testing.
If you look for the Joan Baez recording of this online, you'll find she says, I'm promising you the gentlest protest song I know. It doesn't protest gently, but it sounds gentle. So a little surreptitious. Just a little rain falling on the ground. Grass lifts its head to the heavenly sun. Just a little rain. Just a little boy standing in the rain. The gentle rain falls free, and the grass is gone. The boy disappears, and rain keeps falling like helpless tears. And what have they done?
As Unitarian Universalists, we affirm and promote seven guiding principles. And the fifth of these is the right of conscience and use of a democratic process within our congregations and in society at large. And we do exercise quite well that right of conscience, whether it's through individual reflection and careful thought, or through group discussions and participating in other types of consciousness-raising activities. At times, we move between the private spheres and the public square. Sometimes we may even move into the streets. I suspect that I'm not alone in being led by conscience to participate in the democratic process in ways like showing up at town meetings, voting and campaigning, or rallying or marching in the streets for very specific causes. When I marched some years ago in Washington, D.C. to protest the Keystone Pipeline, and then in New York City for the People's Climate March, perhaps some of you were there, I was very moved by the passion of the crowds. The calls and responses kept us energized and engaged as we walked the long distances, even while our bodies and feet were tiring. Those chants and those shouts took on a life of their own, and they wormed their way into my ears and they embedded themselves in my conscience. Now, how many of you have had an experience in a march or a protest or a rally or a concert like that? You just can't get the words out and they pop up at all times. How many of you have answered in return when prompted, this is what democracy looked like? This is what democracy looked like. You've been there, you know what I mean. That became more than just a slogan to me and has become a way of looking at areas of communal life through the lens of the democratic process. It's become a way to question and probe. This is what democracy looks like? And it's become a way to better strive toward a better union and to affirm This is what democracy looks like. Now, what we think democracy should look like has, of course, been shaped by our country's history and the social and political movements since the days of our founding fathers. Many of us entertain quite grave notions about the failing and broken democracy we sense around us. A popular meme has made its way through social media. I've seen it on Facebook. And it says, and I'm paraphrasing here, democracy or the system is not failing. It's doing just what was intended, preserving the political power and capitalist interest of wealthy, elite, male landowners and their heirs. Now, my apologies if that sits harshly with any of you or your identity and social location. It's not meant to be an attack, but more of an observation. But in fact, in our country, the origins of we the people were never as inclusive as we might like to think today. One man, one vote was just that. One man, one white man, not one person. Not women, not Native Americans, not black slaves or indentured servants. And extending and sharing the power of the vote with others came only through long struggles and over many years. It was in 1870 that the 15th Amendment was passed, stating the right to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. Yet women did not win the right to vote until 1920. Native Americans were not able to vote until the passage of the Snyder Act in 1924, which admitted them to full citizenship. And African Americans faced legal barriers at state and local levels that prevented them from exercising their right to vote until the Voting Rights Act of 1965 was passed. Sadly, barriers to full participation in the democratic process continue to materialize in our country. They are difficult to eradicate. We like to say we have a representative democracy, but it's never really been equally representative. From 1787 until 1861, we had the so-called Three-Fifths Compromise, where African men were considered three-fifths of a human being and not fully represented in our government structures. Our two senators per state rule tend to prioritize geography and statehood over population, diversity, and proportional representation, so that, for instance, each California senator represents nearly 19.8 million people, and each Wyoming senator at the opposite end represents 290,000 people, a very big disparity. In general, the smaller, more rural states also reflect less racial and religious diversity, and therefore our Senate is skewed and not quite really representative of our nation's diversity. Then we have the process and structure of our Electoral College, which tend to privilege a politics of persuasion and finances and special interest over the collective will and desires of the people, something we saw in the last presidential election where the popular vote greatly outnumbered the Electoral College results. This is what democracy looks like? I wonder what taking back or reforming our democracy might look like. I wonder, to give each person one vote, and to assure that all voters can get to the polls, and to prevent polling places in disadvantaged communities from being closed, and to prevent new voter restriction laws from being implemented that target marginalized populations, solely, it seems, for the purpose of maintaining the political power of the establishment. One of our UUA Common Read books last year was Daring Democracy, Igniting Power, Meaning, and Connection for the America We Want. In it, the authors Francis Moore LaPay and Adam Eichen point to four types of groups that have laid the groundwork for what she calls the democracy movement, the movement of movements we're in right now. And those four types are people who are reform crafters and campaigners, think tank members, legal center workers, and those who work at centers providing essential data. These are the kind of organizations that are working for voter reforms and advocating for solutions, like declaring Election Day a national holiday, like automatic registration, like same day and no ID voter registration, like extended voting periods and poll hours. But the success of organizations and initiatives like these will depend, according to LaPay and Eichen, on the democracy movement continuing to embody some qualities that have given it rise. The first is making visibility a conscious tool, one that invites the participation of new friends and allies and fosters a sense of purpose in energizing learning in action, in contrast to operating secretively or manipulating behind closed doors. The second is decentralizing leadership under a common canopy, in contrast to being run by a super wealthy elite, small group, command and central style. The third is drawing on the energy of hope, which opens people emotionally, makes us more eager to meet others and to learn together, and it enables the experience of joy when we take risks together for a higher calling. Scientists tell us that our brains are affected by hope, and that it helps us envision, cognitively work better to envision solutions. Contrast that, for instance, with the energy that is generated by seeding fear, which is a closing down kind of energy. And the fourth quality they lift up is becoming actively inclusive, embracing differences of race and culture within a common commitment to justice and love of democracy and the democratic process itself, rather than trying to retain the traditional white wealthy base and leveraging racism to defeat opponents. LaPay and Eichen touch upon something I find really interesting, the emotional shift and transformative potential that can await us if we become personally engaged in the political and democratic process. As they explain, for some, such transformative movements occur during protest, which can be a high stakes and scary process. For others, contentious or deliberative political engagement can not only be transformative, but liberating. As in those moments when you go beyond what you had thought yourself capable of. They point out three emotional transformative shifts that add up to what they describe as the thrill of democracy. And I have never come across the concept of the thrill of democracy. I was raised with the duty and the right and responsibility, not the thrill. For them, the first is civil courage, or the power of choosing to walk with fear, by which they mean the fear of protest or arrest, or of looking foolish or being publicly criticized, especially if you do something wrong the first or second time. Walking with fear does change something inside us. It changes how we see ourselves, and it leads us to keeping engaged. The second transformational shift they lift up is the power of discovering deep, deep connections with strangers sharing a higher value. The opportunity is there to move away from the isolation and loneliness that is so pervasive for over 70% of American adults, and to bond with others through meaningful sharing that lifts up our shared common values. Public action for common purpose often means that total strangers quickly become friends, or maybe not so quickly if you're particularly introverted. But interacting within a new community can also alter all of our preconceived notions. Wendy Fields, the executive director of the Democracy Initiative, explains that if people are unified around the same fight, they forget their bias. When people understand the common goal, work together and act collectively, they just get over it, and trust grows. The third transformative shift is an inner shift from feeling like a protesting outsider to feeling like a powerful owner of our democracy. We become one of the guardians and one of the holders of solutions. And this is the shift that elicits us from whose democracy? The response, our democracy. It's subtle and it's real and it's meaningful. Taking on the mantle of citizenship and the responsibility of democracy helps unlock what LaPay and I can call the democratic self, a way of interacting with society that prioritizes patience, learning, accepting discomfort with differences, and creativity in the face of ambiguity. I wonder, where have you felt or sensed the possibility of such a transformative experience? When is it that you have experienced civil courage or fear? When and how have you discovered deep connections with strangers sharing higher values? Do you personally feel a sense of ownership of a democratic process out there in here? And what are the skills and practices that ground you in your daily life so that you can show up as a full participant? If you haven't felt these things, what is it that you think is holding you back? How can we in this congregation cultivate our democratic selves, become patient, more eager to learn, sit with discomfort, and unleash our creativity in the midst of ambiguity and uncertainty and rapid change? The recently deceased African American community organizer and activist, Grace Lee Boggs, has some wisdom to share about this. She does think that our system of representative democracy must now itself become the target of revolutionary change, something she writes about in her 2011 book, The Next American Revolution. She wrote, "For too many years, counting vast numbers of people have stopped going to the polls because they did not care what happened to the country or they didn't think that voting would make a difference. For too many Americans, the will of the people has been to pursue life, liberty, and the pursuit of private happiness and take as little responsibility as possible for governing our country. We've left the job of governing to our elected representatives, even when we know they may serve corporate interests and make decisions that threaten our biosphere and widen the gulf between the rich and the poor." She believed that our will to act has been to act like consumers, not like responsible citizens. She urges us on to reclaiming citizenship and tells us that what we urgently need are impassioned discussions everywhere, in groups small and large, where people from all walks of life are not only talking but also listening to one another. And she thinks this is the best way to create an understanding of the next American revolution, which she sees as a period of building a new, more human, more socially and ecologically responsible, more secure nation. A nation that all of us, whatever our race, ethnicity, gender, faith, or national origin, would be proud to call our own. The purpose of the revolution is to accelerate our evolution to a higher plateau. Plateau of humanity instead of a higher standard of living. It's about practicing a new, more active, global, and participatory concept of citizenship. It's about becoming the change we wish to see in the world. She tells us that the courage and the commitment and strategy required for this kind of a revolution are different from those that require you to storm the public square. Instead of thinking about mobilizing in masses and aggressive struggles on issues like higher wages or better jobs or health care, we need to have the courage to challenge ourselves to engage in all activities that build a new and better world. And we do this by improving the physical, the psychological, the political, and the spiritual health of ourselves, our families, our communities, our cities, our world, and our planet. Very comprehensive approach. At each moment in time, we, you and I, have the opportunity to help build that type of a new and better world, the one that Bog dreamt of, the one the democracy movement envisions and works toward. The potential to experience the transformative thrill of democracy lies before us if we but answer the cry and rise up. If we answer the cry and rise up to put a more just and a more robust democratic process into action, here and out there, let us tend to our own spiritual health in order to do this work. Our own spiritual health individually and collectively as a congregation, so that we can better support the political health of all our communities. Let us become the change we wish to see in this new and better world. What will our democracy look like? I think the answer lies in your response. Let's join together in singing hymn number 108, My Life Flows On in Endless Song.
We invite you to stand in body or spirit. We've got three verses. If the song is not familiar, feel free to let the first verse go by and listen.
Through all the tumult and the strife.
We draw our service to a close by extinguishing the chalice. Please say with me the words printed in your order of service. We extinguish this flame, but not closing words today by the Reverend James Wickman, a retired UU minister. Our time together ends in the days before we come together again. May our actions match our words. May our thoughts be filled with love. And may we truly make a difference in a troubled world. Let's join together in singing our closing song, May the Longtime Sun Shine Upon You. Everyone's invited to stay for refreshments and coffee. And you'll see this wonderful process that happens, sort of by osmosis. Not, we don't even take a vote to see who's going to vote, fold up the chairs and move them to the side so we can bring out the tables. It just happens. Democracy in action, sort of.